Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to drill into Congress's thinking. Wouldn't that be great? Anyway, Tammy Flanagan and I, Tammy, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, Weekly GovExec Columnist, and there's so many other things you do, but good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
What else do you do?
I don't know. I do whatever you ask me to do.
You go to NARF meetings, you answer
anything
emails.
Anything dealing with retirement. I live and breathe retirement.
Don't you? Yeah.
I know.
Okay, so Tammy, and we're going to be entertained and educated today by Dr. Kenneth Gold. Can I call you Ken?
You can.
Okay, and he's a director, and Dr. Marion
Currender.
Okay. Senior fellow and curriculum chair from the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University. Okay. Now, before we get into it, which way do you lean? Left, right, or are you
center focused? Straight down the middle. The Government Affairs Institute is nonpartisan, nonprofit. We were actually created in 1965 by Congress in legislation to be part of what was then the United States Civil Service Commission. Civil Service Commission became the Office of Personnel Management in 1979. GAI was then privatized by OPM in 1995. We became part of Georgetown University, and we are part of the new McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University. We are nonpartisan. We run programs on Capitol Hill for federal departments and agencies, and it's very important that we remain nonpartisan in terms of what we do. The vast majority of our participants on Capitol Hill are federal employees.
And you all have been doing this for a while, huh?
We've been doing this now for, it will be 50 years next year.
Well, almost as long as the Beatles have been on Ed Sullivan.
And where were the Beatles' second stop after Ed Sullivan?
Washington, D.C.
That's it. And the place, and the place is still
cool
there.
Trivia.
They park cars in there now. But anyway, let's get back to the subject at hand. All righty. So when folks are listening, we're center-focused here. And the political dynamics of the current Congress, I won't say I'm a real political type, but it's just hard for me sometimes to read the paper or listen to one roadblock versus an opening versus no opening versus whatever. What's your take on this Congress?
Well, at this point, we're not expecting to see a whole lot accomplished legislative-wise this year. We are in the second year of the 113th Congress, and the first year, last year, was the least productive first year of a two-year Congress on record. The 112th prior to the 113th was the least productive Congress since the Civil War. The 113th is on track to break that record. So, you know, when I say that it's the least productive, what I mean by that is that it has passed a very small number of bills. So one could argue that there's a problem with measuring productivity that way, because if you're looking at the number of bills passed, a big bill like the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare bill, that counts the same as a bill that would name a post office or something. So there's sort of a weighting problem there when you're measuring productivity by number of bills passed. There's also what you might consider a bundling problem. We're passing more and more big bills these days than we used to in the past. So there's a lot of omnibus bills that contain a lot of bills all, you know, bundled together into one. But, you know, that said, we still are having a great deal of trouble passing legislation. And much of that has to do with the fact that we have not only a divided government where we've got one party in charge of the White House and then split party control in Congress, but we have a divided Congress. And that really, I think, is at the heart of what causes the low levels of productivity that we see today. You've got one party, the Republicans, in charge of the House and the Democrats in charge of the Senate, and the two can't seem to come together and agree on much of anything.
That's right. Yeah. But they did get some of those big bills passed, I suppose, so that we could avoid, hopefully, the sequestration effects again in the government this year. Is that pretty much the sentiment?
They did pass a budget agreement last year, and it was a compromise called the Ryan-Murray Agreement, named after the chairs of the House and Senate Budget Committees, Paul Ryan and Patty Murray. And that agreement set discretionary spending levels, which are important to federal employees. These are the numbers that pay for all of the federal departments and agencies, both defense and non-defense. So this is the approximately $1 trillion, one-third part of the overall federal budget, the remainder going to mandatory programs and to interest on the debt. And that Ryan-Murray agreement set a top line for both FY14 and enabled the passing of the Omnibus Appropriations Bill in January, which set the spending levels for the remainder of this fiscal year, did increase levels over the sequester levels, and gave federal departments and agencies some certainty, at least for the fiscal year, in that they actually have appropriations bills. Now, the Ryan-Murray Agreement also set a top line for FY15. So on the good news front, it is likely that we will have appropriations bills this year. And because that top line number is already set, the appropriations committees don't need to wait for numbers to come from the budget committees, which is how the process works. The way the process normally works is that the House and Senate budget committees write budget resolutions. And by the 15th of April, they are supposed to agree on a joint congressional budget resolution, and that sets the top line discretionary numbers for that fiscal year. And it's at that point that the appropriations committees start meeting and dividing that money up into the 12 different appropriations subcommittees. This year, because they already have that number as a result of the Ryan-Murray agreement, they don't need to wait for House and Senate budget resolutions, and there's some question whether they'll even write them this year. And they can start the appropriations process today if they choose to do so. And there's some discussion that, at least on the House side, they're already starting to meet on the appropriations bills. So it's possible that we'll have 12 appropriations bills passed by 30th of September. And that would be the first time that happened since 1994.
Well, then wouldn't that mean that it was more productive then if that does happen?
One could suggest yes.
At least from the government employees' point of view, that we won't have to worry about getting furloughed the following year or another fear.
And if there's one thing that Congress ought to do and is required to do each year in the absence of anything else it does, is pass those bills that fund the federal government. And the fact that it has failed to do so time and again over the last 20 to 30 years, it's extremely frustrating for a lot of people.
Sure.
And makes managing in the departments and agencies extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah, and it gives the public and I think even the federal employees a little less confidence in the job security of the government and the programs that the government manages.
Absolutely.
Now, our listener base is saying, well, what about us? They came to listen to you all today, tell them how these bills may or may not impact them from a positive standpoint. Is there anything zeroed in to the federal employee? I mean, we're dealing with the agency level, but our listeners are either retired or they're about to retire or even mid-career.
Well, in the omnibus appropriations bill that they passed on January 15th, that funds the remainder of fiscal year 14, there was a 1% federal pay raise. Now, I know that's not a lot, and the fact that their pay has been frozen for the previous 3 years, we got a 1% pay raise. However, that's better than zero.
that's how the employees feel from the ones I've talked to. They're happy we got something this year.
Yeah.
So they're taking that as a positive sign.
Right. And if there's another pay raise, it would be in that neighborhood. I wouldn't look for it to be any larger than that in FY15.
Was there anything included that would allow for that to happen, or does that have to be yet determined?
That has to be determined separately. The only thing that was set in Ryan-Murray that affects FY15 is the top-line discretionary number plus separate caps for defense and non-defense discretionary spending.
Mm-hmm. All righty. When you talk about the 1% COLA, that's for somebody working. Now, our retiree listeners, they don't have They don't go through that same machination, correct?
No, it's already in the law that retirees get a COLA. So if Congress could change those laws that govern the COLA, but the COLA is decided by the Bureau of Labor Statistics each year based on current law.
Now, there is actually a provision in the FY14 omnibus that would reduce the COLA for military retirees who are under the age of 62. And there is ongoing discussion in both chambers right now about undoing that to restore that cost of living increase to military retirees. And that, in fact, may emerge as part of the debt ceiling agreement that they're negotiating as we speak.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the chained CPI was talked about, and I think that's still on the table as a possibility. That could affect not only government employees, but Social Security beneficiaries
that is
and military.
Another possible sweetener to get the conservative House Republicans who oppose raising the debt ceiling to go on board to raise the debt ceiling, although I haven't seen that talked about in the last few days.
No, hasn't been a priority this week.
Isn't there I don't know that it's a deadline at the end of February. I was reading something in the paper today. They were looking to have something done by the end of February.
The Treasury Department has declared February 27th as the date in which they need a new debt limit passed by Congress. People will argue that that is a soft deadline, that they can find ways to fund the debt somewhere into the middle of March, but clearly February 27th, because they set that date, is a date that's going to unnerve the financial markets if Congress doesn't pass something before them. The complication is that Congress is going to, the House in particular, is going to adjourn on Wednesday this week and not return for a full day of meeting until February 26th.
Oh.
So they either need to do something in the next
two days.
Mm-hmm. Or they have one day to complete it when they return on the 26th of February. Mm-hmm. There are all indications that the conservative Republicans who put up the major fuss in the last debt ceiling debate are reluctant to do so this time around, that they are have acknowledged that they need to pass a debt limit. The president and the Democratic majority Senate has said they'll only agree to a clean debt limit bill, which means no riders attached. They may wind up accepting some small riders. One of them may be that reverse in the cut to the military COLA that we mentioned.
Right.
It may be something in chained CPI, as you suggest, or some other small bone to throw to the very conservative House Republicans who oppose raising the debt ceiling under any circumstance.
Right.
There's some interesting dynamics going on with that as to whether Speaker Boehner can pass a debt limit extension with Republican votes only, because there's probably 75 Republicans who are going to vote against the debt limit no matter what is included.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were some interesting reports this morning that one strategy that House Republicans could use is just to turn it over to House Democrats, because Minority Whip Steny Hoyer has said that he has 180 Democrats on board who would be willing to vote for a clean debt limit bill on the floor. And so some Republicans have suggested we should just allow the Democrats to bring this bill to the floor, have enough Republicans who oppose it vote present, and then by doing so you lower the number that you would need for a majority to pass something on the floor. So you could either get 180 Democrats plus enough Republicans to bring you up to 218 and then pass the bill that way, or lower the threshold by which you have to pass it by having a number of Republicans vote present and a handful of them vote yes on it, and then you could get it through that way. That's sort of hard to imagine, but it's kind of an
it's almost like playing chess. You move these pieces here
Could I ask a naive question? You mentioned they're going on, quote, recess in 2 days. Does that mean they can't work between that date and kind of the edge of the cliff?
Oh, I mean, they will certainly be working, behind the scenes leadership, no doubt. What's happening this week is that the House Democrats are going on the retreat. The House Republicans went on theirs last week. And so while the House is not in session officially, There will be a lot of activity going on between the scenes and behind the scenes with negotiations with the leadership team in the House and the leadership team in the Senate.
And then another naive question. Aren't they supposed to be there for the greater good? And I'm not taking any side of that. I just look at this and I say,
They are meeting fewer and fewer days each year, and we've seen this progression over a number of years. They were scheduled to meet 97 days this year, I believe. They say when they're not meeting, they're not in recess. These are called district work periods, mm-hmm. and there certainly are responsibilities that they have in the district. So they don't necessarily go play golf or go to the beach during these periods.
They
are not in Washington legislating, and a lot of people think that that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, also something that's interesting as well is that a number of House members, in particular on the Republican side, have taken to staffing up their district offices, keeping more people here in Washington. I'm sorry, fewer people here in Washington and more back in the district offices, because their thinking is that we're spending more and more time back in the district. We're not getting anything done in Washington. And so why waste, precious staff in Washington when we can have them back in the district?
That's where their constituents
are. Yeah, helping us with constituent casework, constituent services, all of those kinds of things. And that affects federal personnel in that you've got fewer and fewer policy staff here in Washington. And so that actually provides an opening for federal employees to do more educating of members and educating of staff who are here in D.C., because there are less, staff who are helping bring members up to speed on the big federal issues of the day.
Is that done through large groups like NARF and other groups like the Treasury unions that lobby on behalf of federal employees? Is that how they get educated, through those means, or is it other ways?
Well, I think, with it varies agency to agency what's allowable in terms of educating members of Congress and congressional staff about the issues that
educating or making them aware of what's important to the workforce, to the federal employees.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of federal employees will take it upon themselves to write letters, and I'm not sure how effective those are compared to collectively, letting Congress know, what's needed or what's not being done, or what could be improved.
Yeah.
As a tax type, sometimes I have to try to explain why a law is or isn't passed, or where did this thing come from? And years ago, I could key into something and I could read something called committee reports. And it was mind-numbing, but it actually spoke to how, in other words, why is 70 and a half a date to take money out of an IRA rather than 70? Why the half? And why 59 and a half for an IRA? And then I read that thing, and it was somebody wanted 90 and somebody wanted 12, and they came up and they divided
compromise.
It by two or three. Yeah. And I found that interesting, and then at least I could explain it.
Right.
I didn't try to use the language in it because it was hard.
It seems like if you dig deep enough, there's always a reason behind a law when it passes, why it's the date that it is, or the reason.
So do they have committee reports for things that our listeners would be interested in?
Oh, sure. I mean, anything that happens in committee, if there's a committee hearing on a piece of legislation that's relevant to federal employees, there's going to be a record of that. And those reports are available on most of the committee's websites or through Library of Congress Thomas.
I've even watched some of those hearings when it's something that's of real relevance to what I talk about to my pre-retirement groups. I'll watch the hearing. It's kind of interesting because you'll have Congress asking questions of the people who are in charge of those programs or who have some influence, and you kind of get a feel for how it's going to go.
Yeah.
After
a lot of what happens in committee hearings, particularly when you're looking at hearings where there's a piece of legislation that's under consideration, most of what happens in those kinds of hearings is scripted. When the committee says we're going to have a hearing, it's because the committee has done all of the background work. They've done the research. They know the chair's position on the bill. They know which way the vote is going to go. So when the hearing is called, staff has written questions, for the members, the witnesses who are testifying.
Have their script.
They have their script. They know what they're going to be asked.
Is that just to make it a matter of record then? for the whole process.
Exactly. A lot of people will say, well, why do they even bother? Yeah. Everyone knows what's going to happen and how the vote's going to go. And it is really important, though, to create that record. Because if that bill does go on to become law and, federal agency folks are at their desk trying to figure out what did Congress mean when they told us to do, to do this, going back and reading that record can help you understand by looking at what kinds of questions were asked of the witnesses, what were they getting at, what were the explanations, that can help them interpret the law, what the law's intent was. And then if that law is challenged as unconstitutional or whatever in the courts, that's what the court uses to determine congressional intent. You know, what did Congress mean when they passed this law? So it is all of that information is public information.
Well, also to address Bob's point as to how they come up with 70 years, 5 months, 3 days, as opposed to 70 years, 5 months, 2 days, is to understand all of the compromises which need to take place in order for a bill to actually become law, that there are multiple points in the referral process at subcommittee level, at full committee level, in the chambers. Bills then have to be conferenced between the two chambers in order to go to the president for his signature. And so it's a very complex process that's a result of compromise rather than, say, an actuarial table which says that it's 70 years, 3 months, 4 days.
Oh, I think compromise is good. It's just when somebody just takes a stand and dig their heels in and says, we're not compromising at all, which I think happens a lot of times recently.
That has happened more and more. Now, the process is designed to make it very difficult to pass laws. And so typically about 3% of bills proposed actually become law. Now, a lot of those are bills to commemorate various occasions or to name post offices, this sort of thing. But it has, as Washington has become increasingly polarized and partisan, there are blocks within the parties that don't want to compromise at all, that they believe they were sent here not to legislate, but to decrease the size of the federal government, which means not passing new bills, not passing new laws.
What do you think it'll take for that to change in the future so that we can go back to being more productive and doing things that are for the greater good rather than just for our party?
Wow. that's sort of the $100 million question. Is,
Please tell Congress what
If you were a Republican, you would say that if the Senate goes Republican this fall, then you'd have a House and a Senate that are of the same party and that they would be more productive in terms of passing legislation. That could happen. But just because you have – if you were to have same party control of both chambers doesn't necessarily mean you would have greater ease at passing legislation and you still have a Democrat president in the White House.
They can – what do you call that? Veto?
Yes. Yeah. Who has the veto? Exactly. And you also have you could override a veto. However, one of the problems with legislating in the past decade or two is that since 1994, we've had very narrow margins in both the House and the Senate, partisan partisan swing between the two parties. And so right now, House Republicans hold 232 seats. You need 218 for a majority. And so Speaker John Boehner can't afford, to lose many of his members on every vote that comes up. And that makes it much more difficult to pass legislation because, there were times when Democrats were in the majority from 1954 to 1994 when they had, 60, 70 seats over the Republicans. And the Republicans for a lot of that time saw themselves as a permanent minority. But when you've got that big of a majority, leadership can say to their members, sure, vote your district. I understand, vote your conscience. I know you can't go with the party on this one, but we're okay. We still have 218. But when these margins are so narrow, every vote counts and members are under tremendous pressure to hold that party line.
No matter what.
Yeah. And so that's been the case for, 10, 15 years now. So it makes compromise that much more difficult.
Another factor is the federal budget situation. So that the way that Congress traditionally has solved our nation's problems is by passing large, expensive programs and spending money to do so. Well, there isn't money to do so anymore, and a lot of members have been elected to Congress on the basis of cutting the federal budget. We now have a $17.3 trillion debt. We're paying in excess of $250 billion a year just in interest on the debt, which is equal to the size of most of the non-defense federal departments and agencies combined. And we're looking at various proposals to continue to reduce the deficit, which puts further squeezes on federal spending. This is what accounts to the fact that federal workers have not received a raise in 3 years, except for this year, they're 1%. This is what accounts for the hiring freezes and the all of the retirements in the federal government. So we're going to be looking at this for some time, mm-hmm. because even under the best fiscal scenario, we're going to continue to accumulate annual deficits in the neighborhood of $500 billion a year over the next 8 or 10 years. And so that 17 plus trillion dollar debt is projected to reach $24 trillion by 2023, which means an even smaller percentage of the federal budget will go to discretionary spending. Right now, 34% of the federal budget goes to discretionary programs. The remainder goes to mandatory programs,
Social
within
Security,
which the big
Medicare.
Three entitlement programs, mm-hmm. Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and paying interest on the debt. The Congressional Budget Office projects that by 2023, not 34% of the budget, but only 24% of the federal budget will go to discretionary spending because of the growth in mandatory programs, but even more so, the growth in paying interest on the debt. Right now, average interest on the federal debt is at 2.4%, with short-term interest rates at zero. So the speculation is that that will probably increase. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at a tremendous amount of pressure on federal spending just by interest on the debt.
Wow.
Could I ask a question? Listening to our president in the State of the Union, there was something called an executive order, and it kind of was like, okay, if the road is closed, I'm going to take a detour and I'm going to go my way. Mm-hmm. How does an executive order work, and does it trump legislation?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that you could that I would describe it as trumping legislation. I think that what you saw in President Obama's State of the Union is sort of a open sign of frustration, of his frustration in trying to work with Congress, where he cannot get anything through. And so instead of, taking the approach of saying, well, I'm going to continue to try to work with Congress, because most people at home would just be watching and thinking, and how is that going to work? It hasn't been a very effective for the past couple of years. He said, well, I'm going to go ahead and do these things on my own. And with executive orders, he can essentially issue directives to the agencies to do certain things, but the issue with executive orders is that they expire at the end of the president's term. Most of them expire at the end of the president's term.
So they wouldn't necessarily be permanent changes.
Right, yeah. And so it's something that, will be in place till the end of his presidency, but the next president coming in, he or she would have to proactively decide to end that executive order. The executive order could stay in place if the next president doesn't, end it or change it in some way. Mm-hmm. But if you had a Republican coming in the White House in 2016, you would see a lot of what President Obama is trying to do through executive order end at that point. Another issue with executive orders is that, much has been made since the State of the Union that, that he's overreaching, this is an abuse of power and that sort of thing. But if you look at executive orders issued by presidents over the past couple of decades, he has actually issued fewer executive orders than mm-hmm. presidents prior to him, G.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George Bush Sr. And so I think more than anything, it's just a sign of his frustration that he can't get anything done.
Sense.
There's been a couple of other interesting observations about how he'll use executive power for the remainder of his term. And something that I was reading that I thought was interesting was him deciding to go private, which was kind of a spin on going public. There's a phrase that presidents, when presidents can use their power to go public when they can't get Congress to do what they want to do, they go to the public mm-hmm. and say, hey, help me out here, put pressure on the public. Bill Clinton did a lot of this, put pressure on the public to then make phone calls, send letters to the members of Congress and say, hey, this is something the president's talking about. It sounds important. Why don't you do something?
Yeah, support it.
Right. And so what President Obama has sort of demonstrated an interest in doing is sort of working with the private sector. We saw him congratulating CVS for, mm-hmm. The
not
decision.
Selling cigarettes.
Right, to stop selling tobacco. Michelle Obama partnering with Subway, to offer healthy sandwiches and that sort of thing. Bringing a number of CEOs to the White House to talk about his push to get groups like Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, big employers to hire the long-term unemployed. And, sort of taking that mm-hmm. that route where he's, making inroads
make
with the private
with
sector. Yeah.
You
see an example of the limitation of executive orders in that the president in his previous State of the Union addresses has been calling on Congress to raise the minimum wage.
Right.
So what he did this time around is by executive order, he can't raise the federal minimum wage, but he was able to raise the minimum wage for federal contractors.
Mm-hmm.
So he took that. But
kind
it's an example
set
of
an
the
example.
Severe
yeah.
limitation mm-hmm. of an executive order compared to what legislation could do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, you each have your areas of expertise. Ken, we've known each other for a fairly long time, and I know you're a defense, non-defense kind of budget analyst, guns versus butter. That's an old saying, but real old saying, right? But in today, we see an awful lot of money going to defense, and then we see a tug the other way to for the butter side, in other words, the non-defense. Where are we going with that? Because you just, you basically set out, okay, here's a piece of pie that's left of the pie. How do you slice that up? Do you see that changing going forward?
The most important point of that is the size of the slice that goes to defense and non-defense, in that compared to the overall federal budget, that slice is shrinking. So that means that both defense and non-defense are going to be shrinking. The question is, which shrinks more or how far and how fast? Mm-hmm. And you do see some differences in party there. So you see that in the last House budget resolution passed by Chairman Ryan, there was actually an increase to defense spending and very dramatic cuts to all non-defense discretionary spending. And Chairman Ryan will be writing a budget again, and even if it doesn't impact FY15 because there's already a discretionary limit set by the Ryan-Murray agreement, it will look 10 years out. Mm-hmm. And over that 10-year period, it's been leaked officially that the Ryan budget will attempt to balance the budget in 10 years. That will mean some very significant changes on the mandatory side in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
That's what I was going to ask about, because to me that's the biggest hurdle that Congress is going to face.
That's
in
driving
10 years.
The deficit and the debt to a much higher degree than discretionary spending. But politically, it's very difficult to address these, and it will be interesting to see how far out on a limb he's willing to go, especially given that 2014 is an election year.
Mm-hmm.
On the defense side, it's likely that the Republicans, especially in the House, will lobby for higher defense spending, while the Democrats will lobby for higher non-defense spending in traditional Democratic priorities, education, healthcare spending, things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the 10-year period. But in terms of defense, we've seen drawdowns after Vietnam, after the end of the Cold War, that have been in the neighborhood of 25% to 30%. So it is likely that we'll be seeing a defense drawdown somewhere in that neighborhood, probably not as drastic, probably in the 20 to 25% range.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at a defense budget going forward that will be cut over the next 8 years, say, by 20 to 25%. And this is extraordinarily difficult to do for Congress. That's why it's easier for them to cut discretionary programs than mandatory programs. But getting at defense programs means that iron triangle, the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about. So the defense lobbying community industry is a very powerful force in Washington.
It supports a lot of our economy.
Supports mm-hmm. defense spending in general, especially on major weapon systems. Mm-hmm. So we are embarking right now at the front edge of some very large defense programs, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, building new aircraft carriers, a replacement fleet for the ballistics missile submarines that go out into the future that we simply can't afford at this point. So some very hard choices need to be made, and we don't see them being made at this time.
I think, you know, with this idea with changing the big entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, if I think there's two ways to look at Congress thinking about making those changes, because some of them might say, well, this is politically devastating because it affects everybody in the country. But on the other hand, the country is tired of waiting for those programs to change, and we know they're going to change. We've been warned about it since 1983, since the last changes, so it seems like it could go either way. And there are so many ways that they could change that to help shore it up for the future.
We know this is a problem. 10,000 baby boomers are retiring every day. The mm-hmm. demographics are frightening. Mm-hmm. When one looks at this, the General Accountability Office recently issued a projection that suggests that by 2025, this is in about a decade, that virtually all federal revenue will be required to pay for the big three entitlement programs and interest on the debt, and there'll be nothing left over for any other programs, including all discretionary programs, defense and non-defense. So all will be need to pay paid for through borrowing. And that's a very frightening picture to look at.
Yeah.
Do you ever see a means testing to Social Security? Well, I mean, with all these people, myself included, heading towards that.
It already is means tested.
I thought Medicare.
Well, not collecting it, but paying is now means tested in that you don't pay payroll taxes above, I think it's $114,000.
Right. And when you get the benefit, it's tilted.
It's not enough to regress
in that sense right now.
But what if they were to say if your income is above X, you're going to lose some of your Social Security benefits?
But we could already solve that.
Social Security right now. We can solve the problem in the next 60 seconds. By raising the retirement age further, so right now it's 67 for the youngest workers. You know, one of the things I like to point out to people is that when Social Security was passed in 1935, it set the retirement age at 65. And the reason for that is that the life expectancy for women was 66, and for men it was 64. So
it wasn't designed to support people over 30 years in retirement.
Mm-hmm. So that change should be made and could be made. The problem is making it politically, that seniors are the strongest lobby in our country.
Yep, they have the most and time on their hands.
The organizations that represent seniors are the most powerful lobby. So it's very difficult to make those changes and similar kinds of changes in Medicare, which could be means tested.
Which makes me think that they'll change them to grandfather them in so that the seniors of today won't be affected. Just like in 1983, if you were born before a certain date, didn't affect you. But for the youngest folks coming out of college who already don't count on Social Security,
So we've been saying for years, as you point out, we need to make those changes. It's very obvious we need to make those changes, and yet politically it's extraordinarily difficult for Congress to make those changes.
They won't even put them on the table.
And they're certainly not going to be looking at it this year, an election year, that these were going to be ingredients of the so-called grand bargain that President Obama and Speaker Boehner were negotiating a couple of years ago that fell apart. So there's little prospect of that happening anytime soon.
That's a shame.
Wow. Oh, gee, that's great. Maybe we can get a happy caller. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And if you've been listening, I'm sure you have some questions. Tammy and I have had some, so you all have to as well. Anyway, there was a comment here, money and politics. That was one of the talking points. It sounds like Moneyball, the movie. Is work the kind of same way?
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting, and I was just thinking this as Ken was speaking about the senior citizens being one of the most powerful lobbies. Interestingly, the AARP is huge. They are, you know, incredibly respected and feared on Capitol Hill. But it's all by force of volume and interest in the issues. AARP does not participate in politics from a campaign finance perspective. They don't have a political action committee. They're not contributing money to candidates for office, yet they still claim, you know, a tremendous amount of respect on the, and as I said, fear.
Just because it represents such a large population.
Right, right, mm-hmm. on Capitol Hill. But I think there's no doubt that, money plays, campaign money plays a big part in all of this.
How does that actually work?
House members are up for re-election every 2 years, senators every 6 years, and from the moment they are elected, they're running for re-election, and it requires them to raise a tremendous amount of money. So over on the House side right now, the average cost of winning a House seat's over $1.5 million.
So these committees will raise money to support that campaign.
Well, each member is responsible for raising their own money, and they traditionally have gotten help from the party organizations and then also help from outside groups. What's happening today that makes the landscape so much more unpredictable is that we see the rise of a lot of these independent expenditure groups on the in the wake of the Citizens United decision. The Supreme Court said that it is okay for you know, for corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money, you know, advocating either for or against a candidate for office, as long as their campaigns are not coordinated with the candidate's campaign. So if Ken was running for office and I supported his candidacy, I could spend millions and millions of dollars running ads on his behalf.
And then he would feel obligated to you to do whatever you wanted
afterwards. Well, you know, that's the big question. But all of that's legal as long as he and I don't talk about it. But, you know, what we see happening today is because these groups that spend, you know, tremendous amounts of money on campaigns have become such active players in the process, the party organizations are actually sort of backing down. The Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee have both said that this year they're not raising and spending as much on campaigns because
they don't have to.
They don't have to. And also because they donors are more interested in giving to these organizations that can sort of direct funding in a way that the parties
represents
don't.
What they want to happen.
Right. Probably. So if I was a big proponent of the you know, the Democratic Senate candidate in Arkansas. And I wanted to make sure that the $1 million that I had to give was going to get to that candidate. If I gave it to the Democratic National Committee, you know, that sort of just becomes part of the pool that they spend on their candidates. But if there is a super PAC that's set up in Arkansas for the purpose of reelecting this person or getting that person elected, it's a much better decision, you know, financially to invest your money into that.
I guess that's why, like, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, why a lot of federal retirees especially donate to that, because they know it's going to support the agenda that's going to benefit their
Yeah, so the more narrowly, you know, focused or targeted you can be with your contribution, the more appealing it is.
Are there reporting requirements of PACs to the public and or to, say, the IRS or Congress? You know, how much did we raise? And I would imagine, but I don't know, if there's a ceiling on what one person, not necessarily a corporation, can give.
Yeah.
Remember years ago on a tax return, you could get $100 a presidential election fund. But PAC, political action campaign, is that what it is?
Political action committees.
Committees,
yeah. There's just so much gray area here now because of all of the recent changes in the law. I mean, there are limits on what any one individual can contribute to a member of Congress and to a party committee. But when it comes to giving to these super PACs, there really are no limits. Some of the money has to be reported and some of it doesn't. What we see, I'm trying to think if I can explain this in a way that's not overly complicated, but what we saw happen in the last presidential election was that a number of these groups, Karl Rove's group, Crossroads, for example, they're super PAC and they have to report contributions to their organization. There are a lot of big donors who don't want to have to disclose the fact that I am giving $10 million to this group. And so so what they've done is find ways around that by giving to 501c that are affiliated with American Crossroads. So you give to that group that reports to the IRS and doesn't have to, you know, say these are the individual donors who are giving to us, And then that group can give a massive contribution to the super PAC. And then it just shows up on the super PAC's contribution list as, you know, $1 million donation from this nonprofit. And you don't know who's giving the money to the nonprofit. So there are ways around all of this. It just depends on which way you're choosing to give.
Okay, now the listeners, you're not going to get a tax deduction for that.
Yeah.
There was an interesting example of this that happened within the last couple of weeks when the Republicans came out of their retreat 2 weeks ago. They issued a statement of principles on immigration in which they said that they would be willing to support immigration that led to legal status. That's certainly short of citizenship, but was viewed as great progress among proponents of immigration. And all of a sudden, there was a lot of discussion in Washington that Congress would pass some sort of limited immigration legislation this year. And then less than a week after they issued these principles, Speaker of the House Boehner got on and reversed that and said, no, we're not going to support any immigration legislation this year. And the speculation is that the super PACs weighed in, that this was something of a trial balloon to see how forceful they would weigh in against any sort of immigration legislation, and apparently they succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Just seems like there are a lot of barriers to getting things done.
Right.
Not just the political barriers, but money barriers as well as
different interests. I spoke earlier about how members are under tremendous pressure from their leadership to vote the way the party wants you to vote because the margins between the parties are so narrow. But what's different today also is that members are under tremendous pressure from these outside groups to vote the way that these groups want them to vote.
Because they're working for them and their constituents.
Right, because you know they're not – many members are not as fearful of going up against their leadership as they are as going up against the Koch brothers. You know, if I take a position that opposes, you know, where they stand on this issue, then I risk them throwing millions of dollars into a race to defeat me. And so they have to be mindful of where all these outside groups stand on the issues as well.
Traditionally, if you were an incumbent and you decided to run again, that the nomination would pretty much be yours, except if you had done something terribly wrong, something particularly horrendous that would cause your constituents to oppose
that.
You. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, over the last half dozen years or so, incumbent members are being primaried. It's a new verb in our language, being primaried. And so they worry about being primaried. The Democrats about being primaried from the left, and even more significantly, Republicans worry about being primaried from the right. And this may also account for the Speaker's reversal on immigration, in that the conservative wing of the party, which fears being primaried by even more conservative members in their districts, rose up and said, we just can't go along with anything having to do with immigration, knowing full well that this will be extraordinarily harmful to them if they want to recapture the White House in 2016.
Mm-hmm. So it's two different
ways. On that issue, there's a tension between the House and the Senate because I was reading something this morning that said that there are only four Republican members of the House who have populations of 25% or greater Hispanic in their districts. And so there, you know, on the House side, there isn't a lot of, you know, there aren't a lot of Republicans who are, you know, running scared about this issue. But on the Senate side, it's quite different when you're representing an entire
state.
Yeah. And so, you know, the Senate has more of an obvious interest in wanting to, you know, to address this issue than the House does right now. But just like Ken was saying, in the long term, though, it's detrimental to the party to not.
Of the Western states which had become reliably red Republican over the last few years, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and they are looking at dramatic increases in their Hispanic populations. Mm-hmm. So those states which were reliably red are becoming bluer, and the senators, Republican senators in those states, need something on immigration reform. So there's that dynamic, that tension that Marion discusses between the House and the Senate. And also it's clear that a decision not to undertake any immigration is a decision that supports the House in particular at the expense possibly of the Senate and certainly of a presidential nominee in 2016. Mm-hmm.
It's a huge issue.
This is all very interesting. So the folks listening, as well as myself, and maybe I should say Tammy, how do we get? Do you have a website that explains what we just went through and what you all do?
We do.
And how might somebody access that?
Our website is gai.georgetown.edu. We have a monthly newsletter, which has become increasingly a weekly newsletter, in which we talk about these issues, as well as a blog. And our focus is not just on Congress, but what is important for federal personnel, for individuals who work for all of the departments and agencies in the executive branch to know about Congress.
Right.
And we welcome subscriptions to that. They are free. Or anyone to look at our website. And these are the kinds of things that we try to pay attention to, not just Congress, but things that are significant to federal employees. Mm-hmm. It is gai.georgetown.edu.
Yeah, I always say the biggest reason that people are afraid of certain things, like what Congress could do to their benefits, is because we don't understand how that works. Mm-hmm. If you have a better understanding of it, then you know what to expect.
Right.
So
it doesn't
I know
make
I,
your life any better.
No,
but at least you
have a better feel for confidence in knowing that my benefits are going to be protected because of this.
You know, we think it's really important for executive branch employees, especially those who have management responsibilities, especially those who have any responsibility for federal budget decisions, to understand how Congress works, to make the decisions that they do.
Okay, we just under 2 minutes to go. Do you have a crystal ball when the logjam will break? Do we go to the end of February and spook the markets?
It is very difficult to predict because a lot of the traditional models that political scientists use to predict how Congress will act simply don't work anymore, that we have a very different sort of Congress, and the system is quite different than it used to be. We take one step forward, so we all applauded the fact that Speaker Boehner came out of the Republican retreat with some principles on immigration, only to see him reverse himself a week later. Yeah. There is a very strong consensus that we're not going to have a debt ceiling crisis on February 26th. Or February 27th, that they will pass a bill, they'll pass it somehow. And again, the fact that we have appropriations bills for this year and are likely to have them for next year is also good news for
positive
federal employees.
Well, that's ending on a positive note.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we want to end on a positive note. Thank you both for being here. It's been a couple years? Year since you came?
I think it's only been a year. It seems longer.
This is always, it is. Tammy?
That's it. Great discussion.
Thank you very much
today.
Thank you.
Right.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks everybody for listening, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.